Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Biking is year-round now, including bike racing. It's a phenomenon that started here in Alaska and now has spread over the world. Folks are fat bike racing all over the U.S. and in Europe. On today's show, we're checking in on competition in our region, including the Iditarod Invitational, which helped start fat bike riding in the first place, and the Frosty Bottom, which gives every Anchorage cyclist a chance to try a race of 25 to 50 miles. At the end of the show, we're also going to check in on Alaska's biggest citizen bike race, the Fireweed 400, which happens in the summer on the highways around Glen Ellen. But right now, my guest is Will Ross, who's one of three race directors for the Frosty Bottom, which is a pretty unique race, a wintertime race that runs all around the bike trails of Anchorage. And it's coming up shortly. What's the date of the race?
The date of the race is January 14th.
Yeah. And it's a primarily a fat tire race, though I guess in the past it's had other categories.
Yeah, in the past we've had skiers and runners, or bikes of any kind. But yeah, due to snow conditions over the last couple of years, we're trying to limit it to just fat bikes. The skinny tire bikes do tend to tear up the trails.
Yeah, and I guess the probably wasn't enough snow to do for the skiers.
No, skiers had a rough time the last couple of years. Yeah. Last year I don't believe we even had one skier. So we did have a couple runners, but still icy for them too.
Yeah, and I guess the duration of the race must be very different for a fat tire bike and for a runner.
Yeah. Runners tend to do it in 7 to 8 hours, and the top bikers tend to do it in under 3 hours.
Uh-huh.
So our timers are out there a long time.
Yeah. So this year, and I guess from now on, it's just going to be bikes only.
It's bikes only this year. And from now on.
Mm-hmm. So how many people normally enter the race, and you know, how big is the field?
The field, I guess, we've usually had between 250 and 350 people. Uh-huh. We don't cap the race, so we'll let anyone sign up.
And do you just mass start?
Two waves. So we'll have one wave for the long course or the full Frosty Bottom. And then either 5 or 10 minutes later, we'll have a wave for the short course.
Uh-huh. Do you get a lot of folks who want to maybe try out their first race? Because, I mean, for some races, like the Iditarod Invitational, you already have to be like a super duper outdoors person even to get the race, right? And this is maybe an opportunity to do something more introductory.
Yeah. Well, and that was one of the things that created the race. It was the idea was to give participants a way to train for something like the Susitna 100 or the Iditarod Invitational in an urban setting where you're still in town, and it's also a shorter course. Mm-hmm. So it gives people those opportunities to train for cold weather and kind of learn their equipment without really being that far away from civilization.
Yeah, it's pretty safe.
Yeah.
You just dump off and go to cars if you want.
Yeah,
to.
Well, one year I did have an ultra bonk. I just ran out of energy, and I tried calling every member of my family because I was in town. Come pick me up at Westchester, and well, nobody answered their phone, so I had to finish. But uh-huh. But yeah, there is that possibility. You can ditch if you have to.
Yeah. So let's go over the course. And it's a 25 and a 50 kilometer or mile?
Roughly. So the
kilometers or miles?
Miles. Uh-huh. So the short course, we originally called it the 25 and the 50, but it was like a 22 and a 43. But now for this year, we changed the short course. Previous years, it went from Kincaid all the way up to finishing at Hilltop. But this year we're doing an out and back for the short course. So it'll start at Kincaid, head out the coastal trail, head up the Chester Creek Trail, turn around at Goose Lake, and then finish back at Kincaid. And then the long course, the full Frosty Bottom, that goes from Kincaid, along the coastal trail, up the Chester Creek Trail, and then along the Tour of Anchorage Trail, up and around Hilltop, and then back to Kincaid. But this way it gives us all our timers can stay in one location. Everyone finishes at Kincaid. Everyone starts at Kincaid. It just creates a better race atmosphere. Everyone's kind of finishing at the same place around the same time. We'll have pizza at the finish line.
Okay, cool. Do you have any support along the way?
Yeah, there's going to be, for the short course, there will be an aid station at Goose Lake at the turnaround. So that's 12 miles in. And then the long course, the full Frosty Bottom, can hit that aid station at Goose Lake. There will also be an aid station at Hilltop, and then they can hit the Goose Lake aid station on the way back. So you're never more than 6 or 7 miles away from food and water.
So I'm curious, when you've got hundreds of cyclists starting out at once, and the coastal trail is not that wide, that must be quite the traffic jam.
Well, it's pretty exciting. In the past, we've had a neutral rollout down that first coastal trail hill from Kincaid down until you hit the flats there on the bluff.
Neutral rollout meaning what?
No passing, no aggressive riding.
Okay, yeah.
A couple people kind of take it upon themselves to be the leader and roll at a reasonable pace.
And then you're hoping that it's going to stretch out over the course of a long race?
Yeah, I guess.
Because there's going to have to be some passing, right?
yeah. Once the trail becomes flat at the bottom of that hill, then, yeah, it's race on.
Uh-huh.
But this year, we got permission to do a new, a new start. So we'll be starting at one of the bunkers out there at Kincaid. And we've got access to a road, so we'll have almost a full kilometer of, flat land to race on, and wide.
So is it just the road out there to Kincaid Park?
It will be, the roads connecting some of those soccer fields out at Kincaid.
Oh, I got you.
So we'll get to use that, and that will, give us an opportunity to not have to do a neutral rollout.
People will just be fighting it out.
Yeah.
Right from the
very start. Duke it out before the downhill and then.
Yeah. Cause I would think that once you get in that narrow trail, then you've really got some strategy and to think about, because getting up to where you want to be.
Exactly. Yeah. Most people are pretty good about self-seeding, which is nice. Mutual respect to everybody.
Yeah. The bigger the field, the more challenging that becomes.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, have you ever started a race where you find yourself for whatever reason, way, way behind where you should be.
Mm-hmm.
And you just you're spending the whole time passing and passing and passing.
Well, the very first time I did the race, well before I was ever a director or anything for it, I realized I forgot to take my warm-up jacket and warm-up pants off. And so 2K into the race, oh no, I'm way too hot. So pulled all that stuff off, got passed by a couple hundred people, and had to work my way all the way up to the front.
Yeah.
By the time I did, I was cooked.
Do people do a pretty good job of staying in single file so people can pass, or is that an issue?
It's most of the time it's single and double file. Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the kinds of people who are doing this race, because since it has this potential for being introductory, I'm wondering if you have a lot of sort of newbies who never done any bike racing, or certainly any fat bike racing.
Yeah, I mean, there's all walks of cyclists do mm-hmm. this race. We've got professional cyclists duking it out for the prize purse at the front. And then you have absolute beginners doing the short course. It's a great race for a beginner cyclist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the snow must be pretty darn packed down. Especially if you're towards the back. I mean, one of the things I've noticed about fat bikes, because I'm mostly a skier, is they do pack down, especially if there's a little bit of soft snow. Most people will stay in a narrow channel, and you'll get sort of this little hard
trail. That little
trail.
Luge run?
Yeah. If you're a skate skier, you may not like that much. But is that sort of what happens in the race?
It depends on how long before the race the trail is groomed.
Mm.
Right now, the coastal trail hasn't been groomed once.
Yeah.
And that's a little nervous for it, for us.
And we're pre-recording. So by the time the race starts in January, it probably will
be
different.
Now that we got the snow, a little bit more snow. Yeah. It should get groomed. We've kind of just been waiting, or the groomers have been waiting on, the two bridges, by Westchester and then one, near Point Lorenzo.
I just skied that the other day, and it's before Christmas, folks, as we're recording, but it was so cool to be able to go over those bridges, you know, and that they're all new and they'll be there for decades. But what are we going to call the one out by Kincaid? It's not blue.
Yeah.
Everybody called that the Blue Bridge. I don't know. I think that this summer they need to go out and paint it blue.
Yeah. I don't know what you'd call it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that bridge is up. I don't know about the Westchester
Bridge.
Yeah,
it's up. I went over it. Yep.
It's completed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that helps us out a lot.
Isn't that sweet? Yeah, I'm really excited about that. It really, when you don't have it, you realize how you miss it.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking about the Frosty Bottom and the Fat Bike Race, which is going to be starting taking place next week with Earl Ross, who is one of the co-race directors on Outdoor Explorer. And my name is Charles Wolforth. So tell me about how you got into this sport. I think it's, were you already a mountain bike racer before you got a fat bike?
Yeah, I was already a mountain bike racer. And I grew up cross-country skiing, so I've always been
winter
you
person.
Know, an mm-hmm. outdoor winter person, yeah. I got a job at Chain Reaction Cycles as a mechanic, and just over the years, my role kind of progressed into race director. Mm-hmm. So I'm service manager at Chain Reaction Cycles, and then also a race director for the Frosty Bottom and our Abominable Snow Series.
Okay. So was there much mountain bike racing before fat tire bikes? I know that there are people who would go like the Susitna 100 or the Iditarod Invitational and walk their bikes, but but I don't know how much like real mountain bike winter racing was really going on until the fat bikes made it much more practical.
There was none until fat bikes. It wasn't until, 907 was created in 2008, mm-hmm. And that was kind of the time when the whole fat bike boom happened. Was from 2008 to 2011, and now it's just completely taken off.
It's everywhere, yeah.
Myself and a former coworker decided, well, there's no other races other than super long races.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created the Abominable Snow Series in, I believe that was the winter of 2011, 2012, just as a way to, make a short race series, each race being between like 30 minutes and an hour and a half, and then people can go home and get warm.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that series. Is that still going on?
Yeah, it's still going on. I guess it's been renamed the Abominable Winter Cycling Events. Still put on by Chain Reaction Cycles and Beartooth Theater, Moose's Tooth. They're the other sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's each year it differs. Some years we have 7 or 8 races. I think this year there's 5 races. We had our first race on Global Fat Bike Day out at Cuddy Park.
Who knew?
Yeah. it's just a series of short races.
And it sort of laps around a track.
Yeah, the short track that we did on Global Fat Bike Day was about a 1 kilometer lap. And we did that, I guess, you race for a half hour. So however many laps you can do in a half hour. Yeah. But then other races are out at Kincaid on the single track trails out there,
mm-hmm.
and those tend to be more like 5 mile laps, and then beginners will do 1 lap, sport racers will do 2, and then experts will do 3.
Tell me about riding the single track on a fat tire bike. And that's got to be pretty different from summertime.
Oh, it's really the same, other
really?
Than sliding around a lot.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of local guys have been out.
I know that. They get the trails groomed before the ski trails.
They groom them. Yeah.
It's amazing.
A couple of the volunteers for Single Track Advocates, the group that built the trails,
mm-hmm.
Live right there at Kincaid, or very close to Kincaid, and they have snow machines. Then they drag old car tires around and pack it down nice and smooth.
So the skills and the sort of technical aspect of it is pretty similar to riding the trails in the summer.
Similar, yeah. Just more slippery, really.
Yeah.
You do tend to get that rut mm-hmm. down the center of the trail, especially on downhills. And so balance definitely plays a huge factor there.
Is the bike's a bit bouncier, too, isn't it?
It all depends on tire pressure.
Okay.
Yeah, if you run tire pressure that's way too high, one, you're going to be cutting into the snow a lot. And adding a lot of resistance. And yes, it's going to be very bouncy because there's typically no suspension on fat bikes.
Yeah.
And then if your tires are way too low, you do get lots of flotation and lots of traction, but then lots of extra rolling resistance.
A lot of effort, yeah.
Yeah, there is a learning curve to getting the tire pressure right.
Interesting. I want to talk about that in terms of racing, too. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking about fat tire racing and other bike racing today. Right now, my guest is Will Ross, who's the co-race director of the Frosty Bottom, which is coming up. The date again?
January 14th.
And the last registration date is what?
Last registration date is going to be January 11th at Chain Reaction Cycles from 5 to 7.
All right.
But we have online registration going on off the Chain Reaction Cycles events page.
Okay. And we'll make sure we have that site on our website at outdoorexplore.org. Just click on today's show about bike racing. So we were talking a little bit about how fat tire bikes perform, and I'm curious about some of the strategy in terms of being a Frosty Bottom racer. I mean, do you want to like have high inflation because the trail is pretty hard, so you just want to crank out as much speed as you can?
Typically, yeah, you do want a higher pressure than usual, because almost everything is going to be groomed and well packed, especially the last couple years with just the lack of snow and and all the ice. It's been a pretty firm trail. But yeah, you do have to take the snow conditions into account. So a fat tire, you typically run between 4 and 10 PSI, a lot lower than you would on a road bike, mountain bike.
Mm-hmm.
But 10 PSI is almost rock hard. 5 PSI is pretty soft.
Okay.
In the past, I've run right around 8 PSI for the race. And then certain parts of the course, it's way too much. But then other parts of the course, it's not quite enough.
So when you get out there to Bicentennial Park, it's a bit softer? Because I was thinking that like the weight conditions we've had in the past few years, just a regular mountain bike would probably do you fine.
A regular mountain bike would do you just fine. It's the main difference there is the amount of control you have. Mm-hmm. Fat bikes have considerable more control and traction on snow. The mountain bike might float all right and stay on top. But it does tend to squirm around and
yeah. And then if you run into a soft spot, then you're kind of stuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you go up the tour trail up from Tudor Road over to by Service High School.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Up the tour trail past Service High.
And that can
be
pretty soft at times.
It can be. Yeah. 1 year, it snowed 2 or 3 days before the race and then got groomed the night before. So the snow hadn't had time to set, that year, almost everybody stopped at the Tudor Bridge, let air out of their tires, and carried on.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Which is, I guess, a one-way thing. You're not going to stop and pump it up again, right?
No, you can. And I have brought CO2s with me before, just in case.
Uh-huh.
Just that quick inflation. But no. Easier to let air out.
You don't want to waste that
kind
of time. Yeah. So what are some like winning times in the race, and who are some of the folks that have been most successful?
That's interesting. I mean, winning times have, originally, were around 3 hours. Now they're down to about 2 hours and 40 minutes. That's due to just the evolution of fat bikes, one getting lighter and faster. And two, people learning how to race the race.
Yeah.
It started out, everyone thinks, oh, this is a long race. And so people tried to pace themselves. But now that everyone's racing more, and doing the longer races, is almost a sprint to some people.
Right. In other words, you can crank it out for 2 hours.
Crank it out for 2 hours and survive the last 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And then there's only been two people to have ever won the race twice. It's been, almost every year, it's been a different person that's won it. And it all does. It's quite a bit of strategy and whoever's freshest on the day.
Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know what the track? Well, it's a new course, so you can't really talk about a record.
Well, for the 50 or the full course that's the same course.
That's the same. I got you. So you mentioned that there was a purse. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So there's a cash purse for first, second, and third overall in the full course. So $200 for the winner, both men and women. $100 for second and $50 for third. The idea around that was to attract some of the out-of-state competition.
Okay.
Because fat biking is definitely big in the Midwest and Colorado and Utah.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of races out there, and we're trying to get some of them up here.
So it's so interesting that we invented it, and now they are sort of putting on all the races and getting the pros going, huh?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the I'm sure you're familiar with the Birkebeiner ski race,
mm-hmm.
One of the largest ski races in the world, and certainly the largest in the U.S. They do a fat bike race on that same Birkebeiner ski course. And that's, they're only on their fourth year, but that's become the largest fat bike race in the world. It has, I think this year they're capping it at 1500 participants. But yeah, and it draws everyone. It's drawn, like former mountain bike world champions, like Ned Overend, Olympians, like Travis Brown, pro road racers show up and do it.
So wintertime biking, I mean, I've guess I would naively thought it was like an Anchorage thing, but it sounds like it's going everywhere.
It's everywhere. Yeah. Europe has definitely, taken off. Yeah, there's quite a few races over there in Scandinavia. And then like even in Switzerland, there was a stage race called the Snow Epic.
Uh-huh. So you're getting some of those, national caliber folks from other places that are coming here.
Well, we're trying. We haven't yet. It's
okay.
Alaska's pretty secluded.
Yeah, it's a long way to go.
Yeah.
And it's moving bikes from place to place.
Yeah, exactly.
A real pain, too.
Yeah, fly Alaska Airlines. It's only $75 compared to a lot of the other airlines.
Yeah. So how do you feel like our racers stack up? I'm assuming they must be pretty good.
Yeah, the first year that Alaskans went down to the Fat Bike Berkey, I think we had five Alaskans in the top 10 at the Fat Bike Berkey.
Right.
So that's
still our sport.
Yeah. It's
and how about you? Are you spending a lot of time training and really trying to be one of the top finishers, even though you're race director as well?
I do. Yeah. And you know what? It's tough being a race director and a participant.
I imagine,
most of the time, not so difficult. I mean, training's training, and I just go out after work and
like
ride
anyway,
two or three
yeah.
hours. Oh yeah, it's my life. It's what uh-huh. I do. Yeah, can't imagine myself in any other profession. But yeah, race day, it's tough to be a racer and be a director.
Do your comrades do the same thing?
not too many of them, no. Yeah. I mean, but it is a small community, and everyone does help in one way or another in the cycling community, whether it's
yeah.
the mountain bike series, the road series, or the cyclocross series.
Yeah, I'm curious. Is there a lot of overlap? A lot of people doing
all
of those?
Yeah.
You need a lot of bikes if you're that person.
Yeah.
Of course, that's good for you. You work at a bike shop.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a lot of overlap. It does tend to be mostly the people that do the mountain bike races that will come out to do the fat bike races. But then up here, since so many people have seasonal jobs, work well over full time in the summer, they can't get out too much in the summer. So winter kind of becomes their playground.
Yeah. And once you're once you're like really into it and you're geared up, you can use the bike for everything. You
oh
can,
yeah.
Like get around town. It's a good place to do that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Are you doing that?
I don't commute so much, uh-huh. but I do.
I know our producer does.
Yeah.
Vork, he's saying, well, I can't go record that. I've got a bike, you know, and so we
yeah.
can try to figure out alternative things to do, ways to get around. It's
no,
cool.
I don't commute, just the traffic. It's not the greatest in town, and Anchorage is doing a great job to become more bike friendly.
We're going the right direction.
Definitely in the right direction, yeah. More bike paths, more bike lanes.
And it kind of depends on where you're going. I mean,
exactly.
There's certain places, if you're going, it's reasonable. Other places, it's like you're taking your life in your hands.
Yeah. if you live on Hillside and you're heading either to the kind of the medical and mm-hmm. university district, super easy
then
to commute
sweet,
to.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, if you're trying to head to Midtown, it becomes a little more difficult.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking about fat tire biking and the race that's coming up shortly, which is the Frosty Bottom. And my guest is Will Ross, who is one of the organizers and also a bike mechanic and really involved in the bike community. So what kinds of questions or issues do fat tire bikes have in the shop that might not be an issue for like a regular like mountain bike, or are there no different issues?
That's a great question. Maintenance tends to be there's quite a bit less maintenance on a fat bike. I guess if you ride it just in the winter.
Why is that?
The snow doesn't do too much damage to the bike. you don't really need to lube your chain all that often, although it is good to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just less maintenance because the bike stays fairly clean.
Right, I guess so. Yeah. So, is the technology? I mean, it seems like some of the technology that people are doing on other bikes probably are not relevant to a fat tire bike, like the electric shifters, you know, which I didn't even get in the first place.
The electric shifting does not work well in the cold.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I had a friend in Colorado set his bike up, and it didn't even work in his 30-degree garage. But no, like electric shifting, that hasn't taken off for fat bikes. But
you don't have to worry about suspension. So in some ways, it's a simpler bike.
Yeah, yeah. There are suspension forks, but no, suspension does not do well in the winter. There are aftermarket kits that you can have installed that will help the suspension work better in cold temperatures. But the trails, the snow tends to fill in all the roots.
The big tires give you a lot of cushion.
And the big
too.
Tires, yeah. I mean, a 4-inch tire, it's almost 4 inches of suspension right there.
So what happens to a suspension fork in cold weather if it isn't winterized? Is it just stiff?
Depends on the brand. It's either really stiff and sluggish, or certain forks tend to lose all their air. Other forks, all the oil will seep out, none of which are good.
Right. So if you're just taking your regular mountain bike out and throwing studded tires on it and riding it in cold weather, you might have problems.
You might have issues. Yeah, it's not recommended to ride any suspension, front or rear, in the cold weather.
Okay. If you can lock it out, would that protect it?
Not really. I mean, it might help a little bit just because that oil won't circulate. Mm-hmm. But no, it's not going to help too much.
Yeah. So could you ruin your suspension that way?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not completely ruined, but it would require service by a professional.
Interesting.
Suspension service tends to be around $100, and then a new seal kit along with that.
Yeah. So what makes fat tire bikes so expensive? Is it just because they're a kind of a niche product, or is there something about them that would make them more expensive?
I guess at this point, they aren't that much more expensive.
Really?
Originally, yeah, fat bikes kind of, $2,000 was about the minimum. Mm-hmm. But now there's fat bikes well under $1,000. They're not going to be the lightest or highest quality, mm-hmm. But they do what you need them to do. But yeah, now that they're so popular now, everyone's making one. So the price has definitely dropped. Companies are able to make higher quantities of them, which helps drop the price.
Mm-hmm.
So 907's entry-level bike is $1,699, which is pretty reasonable for a bike you can ride year-round.
Yeah. And the tires are still kind of pricey though, right?
The tires are that's the item that hasn't gone down yet.
Yeah.
There's only a couple companies that make them, or at least that make a high quality tire.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, studded tires, starting price for a pair of studded fat bike tires is going to be around $175.
Yeah. You'll pay more than
per
for your car. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, give us the details about the race one more time.
All right. So, there's two distances. There's a short course for us. Short course Frosty Bottom and a long course. The short course is going to be 25 miles starting at Kincaid. And then the long course is roughly 43 miles from Kincaid to Hilltop and back to Kincaid.
And it's fat tire bike only.
Fat tire bike only. Yeah, January 14th at 10 a.m.
And what's the registration fee?
Registration is going to be $60 for the short course and $80 for the long course.
All right. Well, thanks for being here. Will Ross, co-race director for the Frosty Bottom. Enjoyed having you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we are talking about some of these amazing bike races that we have here in Alaska. And our next guest is someone who's been with us before. Katie Merchant is the race director of the Iditarod Trail Invitational. And this is probably one of the most amazing races in the world. It includes a 1,000-mile distance all the way across Alaska to Nome, but also shorter distances. And Katie and her team select very carefully the people who can be in the race based on their capabilities, but they also have a program to help people develop their skills so they can get up to the level where they can do a race like this. So thanks for being with us, Katie.
Good morning. I'm glad to be on the show.
So tell us about the 2017 race that's coming up, when it's happening, and any changes from previous years.
No changes. It's happening Sunday, February 26th at 2 p.m. We start from Kinnick Lake. It's our 16th annual event. We have 85 racers. We have a really, really stacked field. 50 people are veterans. That means they have done the race before, and a lot of them have done it multiple times. We have 35 rookies. We have 16 women this year, 23 for the 1,000, 50 people in the McGrath race, and 12 people in the 130-mile race. And we have 14 nationalities represented this year.
Wow. It really has become an international event that brings people from a lot of different countries, because it's kind of the hardest, the most extreme event out there, I guess.
It is. We don't claim the toughest. A lot of races claim the toughest, but I think what we can claim, it's definitely one of the longest, most remote winter ultras out there. The 1,000-mile distance on a stretch of, on a course that never crosses a road system is pretty unique. And for those that are doing the 1,000-mile race, they have been doing a lot of winter racing for a long time. They've done the 350. They've done, you know, we have 8 qualifiers in 4 states and 4 countries, in Alaska, Canada, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Idaho, Finland, and Norway. And as you can see, these are all northern countries with cold weather and you know, snow. So, yeah, they've come a long ways to qualify and enter the 1,000-mile race.
So this process of qualifying and building up the capabilities to be able to do the race is a big part of your job, and I understand you actually run camps to help people become eligible or capable of doing the race.
Yeah, we've done, my husband and I have offered these training camps at Flathorn Lake on the Iditarod Trail for over 10 years, and the big thing is that people get really comfortable sleeping outside with just a sleeping bag, four nights in a row, you know, melt snow and make their own water, cook their own meals, and just being outside for extended time in the cold is really important. And of course, we ride the trail and we practice bivvying, we build fires, and it's we're teaching all the skills and people learning to use how to properly use their gear to be very comfortable out there, because we don't offer a lot of support. And the trail is extremely remote. Most Alaskans know that, but for people from outside or even from Europe, it's hard to imagine that we actually never cross the road again. And a lot of people in Europe can't understand why you can't drive to the race course. So that concept of a trail that runs across really remote terrain is pretty unique, and it's also the only time of the year you can actually do this. Travel this trail human powered or on a machine or with a dog sled.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the skills to do that are as you say, it's a unique trail, and it requires unique skills. And so you have to really screen people and make sure they've got the necessary skills, because the safety net out there is minimal. There's not much, people have to rely on themselves, and they're not going to have anybody kind of holding their hands out there. And so it's part of your job is selecting them and also helping them get ready.
Right, right. And it's also their personality. But like you said, the skill set and being comfortable in the cold and being self-sufficient out there, I think those are the most important skills that people have to have. Of course, they have to be athletic and they have to be able to keep moving. But I think the cold weather skills, the winter camping skills, and the Arctic travel, multi-day being out in the cold, those skills, I think, are the most important for people to have and bring into this race.
More so than just the winter biking, which a lot of people are doing these days.
Right, right. And you should know how to what gear to pack and how to pack it and what to carry and how to take care of smaller mechanical issues out there, which, you know, a broken chain or a flat tire can be a big deal when it's 40 below out there. So, you know, there's no bike mechanics along the course, so they have to be able to fix their bikes and keep moving. But the winter, I would say the winter survival, the winter camping skills And being comfortable in those temperatures, that's the most important skills for people to have. And most people that will consider this race do have an athletic background. They come from the endurance racing circles, and a lot of times from a lot more supported events where they have multiple aid stations and multiple checkpoints. But the self-sufficiency, I think, is really a key element. But it's also a true adventure for people to go out there and travel the Iditarod Trail human-powered.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you were doing a camp overseas this year for the first time.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. We had a German lady that moved to Norway when I moved to Alaska. We're both from Germany, and she came and did the 130-mile race this past February. She started a fat biking tour company in Norway, and she's been offering fat bike tours there. And then she asked me, she said, why don't you come over here and do a training camp for Europeans and do one here in Norway where for them traveling to Norway from Denmark, Germany, Finland would be a lot shorter trip. And I said, sure, we'll come over there. We'll advertise it. I'll put it on a website. And we filled up the camp with 12 different people. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited to go over there and see where fat biking is. I was dreaming this up in 2003. I asked my husband, I says, do you think fat biking would ever become popular in Scandinavia? And so the question was left out there, but it just, you know, fat biking has just started to become popular over there 2 or 3 years ago. And it's really happening in Norway, Sweden, and Finland, Denmark, and lots of people from Europe are going there because, you know, there's consistent snow and it's consistently colder than in other parts of Europe.
That's so interesting that and how this technology really developed here in Alaska on races like yours that's now spread all the way to Scandinavia. And I've even seen them, you know, in the lower 48 states, people using them on beaches, and they're kind of everywhere. It makes you proud as an Alaskan to see our innovation spreading like that.
Yeah, I've tried to promote that. The fat bike was really created for this race, you know, on the Iditarod Trail, and it mm-hmm. was an Alaskan idea. And it is pretty neat. But I know there's, in a lot of the lower 48 states, like Idaho, and especially the Midwest, there's a huge, huge number of fat bikers there. I mean, the Fat Bike Berkey had 1,000 riders last year in March.
Wow. I had no idea. So
there's a lot of fat bikers, you know, in the snowy Midwestern and Rocky Mountain states. And I follow this stuff on social media, on Facebook. There's a Frosty series developing in Utah and Canada. And it's all over the place. You know, people looking into fat biking on snow in a lot of states now. It's really booming.
But your race is never going to really grow or become huge, right? Because you're all about wilderness. And there's only a certain, you have to limit the number of people who can do it because of the wilderness quality of it.
Right. And there's a limited number of people. I think that where we are right now, we're going to stay at that limit. But what's really cool is all the qualifiers, is all the shorter races. In fact, it was a 60K fat pursuit race in Idaho. The Susitna 100 has a 50K version. There are shorter races for people to get into this kind of sport. And then I think it's the more extreme and adventurous people that will do the race, but I think it's always going to be a very special group of people. We're trying to keep the number where it's at. And it's just, you know, people have to apply and reapply and see if they can get in. And over the years, they're going to finish other qualifiers, and it's like this huge group of winter fat bikers that are connected on social media, and they're sharing information. It's just a unique bunch of people that are willing to go out there and test their limits.
Interesting. Well, I wonder if it's really changed from a race of kind of survival, endurance, making it to the end, where that's the accomplishment, to one now where it's more about, with 50 finishers, it's really a race about being the fastest and being the best cyclist and the one who can really get over those miles quickly.
And it has been a sprint race the last 3 years.
Yeah, it's really changed. until we get one of these real winters, I guess.
Yeah, we need one of those real winters. And in fact, it was John Lackey that said it, the new slogan became faster than the dogs because his time was faster than the mushing time to McGrath. It was one day, and every time I read it, I'm thinking, wait a minute, something is wrong. It's one day, 18 hours, and 32 minutes from Kinnick to McGrath.
It's unbelievable.
That was in that was in 2015.
350 miles, yeah. 350 miles,
yeah,
it's amazing, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I know for 10 years we were talking about 3 days and something. That was a really fast time to McGrath. And all of a sudden it became one day and 18 hours. It was under 2 days.
That's
there is a really, really competitive field in the lead pack. It's always really exciting to watch. Now that we have the trackers, it's actually really exciting to watch at night or whenever to follow the trackers and see who's passing who and who's speeding up or who's slowing down or resting longer. It's pretty fun to see it unfold. And I know that our Alaskans have a big edge. You know, they train on the trail. They live in Alaska. But I think it's great to see other people from the lower 48 or even from overseas to try to compete with them and see if they can give them a run for the win. I think it's really another element of the race. It is about survival, making it through Alaska, the Alaskan wilderness. But it's been a great race, especially to McGrath. There's definitely a very competitive element.
Super competitive, yeah. Well, we'll all be checking it out in February and seeing what happens this year because so much depends on the depth of the snow and everything else. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Katie Merchant, the race director of the Iditarod Trail Invitational. Thanks for joining us on Outdoor Explorer.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show again. I really do enjoy it, and it's definitely the highlight of our year, and I know it's the highlight for many people to follow it, whether they're family or friends or coworkers, and we, you know, people follow our posts on Facebook. I know we have a lot of fans, and it's a really unique event, and thanks again for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks for being here. All right, well, stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. So in the studio with me right now is Ralph Camellas, who helps organize the Fireweed 400. And the Fireweed 400 is a race or a ride that goes across a good portion of Alaska from Sheep Mountain Lodge down to Valdez, and you can do different distances and you can do different levels of competitiveness. It's sort of the premier kind of long distance kind of race ride in Alaska, right,
sure.
Ralph?
Yeah.
How long has it been around?
It's been around since 2003.
Uh-huh.
Vision of Peter Leakish developed it.
And it's kind of gotten bigger and more people all the time.
The first year we had 125 riders, and now we cap off at 650.
Uh-huh.
Including teams, four-person teams, two-person teams.
So there's a limit to how many people can be in it?
Yes.
Okay.
650 is the number that we feel comfortable with that we can put on a good ride and safe ride.
Yeah. So Peter Leakish was a well-loved guy in Anchorage, an attorney who had done a lot for the ski community and the bike community and quite the athletic family. And he passed away, 2 years ago now?
In December.
Yeah. And so you guys have sort of had to pick this up because he was sort of the godfather or the brain, you know, it was his baby.
It was his baby, and he had attention to details down pat that he left us with a good outline of what needed to be done, and we've had a couple of race directors since then step up to the plate and take over, and our core people behind him help make this race what it is today, and it's a good family-organized ride.
Yeah. So let's give folks a little bit more idea of what it's all about. You start Sheep Mountain Lodge is on the Glen Highway between Palmer and Glen Allen, and that's where most people start, right?
Yes. All the races start there either Friday evening or Saturday morning.
Uh-huh.
The 400s start Saturday or Friday evening, midday, and then the 300K two-day ride start on Friday and end in Valdez.
And it starts midsummer.
The weekend right after 4th of July.
Right, right. And so there's different levels of competitors who are like taking this on, right? I mean, there's people who are really serious bike racers, and then there's folks who are just doing it to show that they can do it, right?
The core riders are family riders that just love riding bicycles. We have a small number of 400 elite riders that use this as a RAM qualifier, Race Across America.
So they're qualifying for a race that goes all the way across, like North America, from San Diego to New York.
Yes.
So you were saying that that the race actually got started because Peter Likish wanted to do that Race Across America.
Well, he qualified for the Race Across America doing the Midnight Sun 600K, which was a race from Anchorage to Fairbanks every year. And that race sort of morphed into the Fireweed, where we have an out-and-back course that you would still qualify for the Race Across America, which Peter did in 2001. He did it as a team racer, and then the following year he did it as a solo racer and got best in his senior division.
Wow.
Had that record for quite a few years up until last year. I think it was broken by somebody that just moved up in age.
That seems mind-boggling to race all the way from one coast to the other in a competition. I guess racing across Alaska probably seems mind-boggling to a lot of us too, but it's not, I mean, it sounds like it's not like something that's only for the extreme athlete, the Fireweed. I mean, it's something that somebody could manage if they're fit, you know, and they've got a decent bike and they're prepared, right?
I think it's a very bonding experience for both family, friends, and kids that want to just participate in a sport that betters them, and they just have a ball doing it. We have a big spaghetti feed the night before the ride on Friday, and then the next day it starts, and everybody's all smiles, and it just worked. It's a great experience for the volunteers and the riders. We really enjoy putting on this event.
So for that typical group, if it's a family group or whoever, sort of what's the race like?
The race for a family can be a relay. You can participate in a 200-mile relay, which starts at Sheep Mountain and ends in Valdez.
Is that the most popular event?
That has grown to be one of the most popular events. We have a two-person relay team, four-person relay team, male or female, and also a mixed division.
So the relay means that, like, you ride for a while, and then you get in a vehicle and drive while somebody else is riding?
Yes, it's four riders, possibly two maybe, and they switch bikes. We have the safe spots for them to pull over and change riders, and it just becomes a leapfrog ride, and people really enjoy it. Some college kids just come out just to do that every year. It's a great time.
Yeah. So, and then I've heard of a lot of people just get together a group of friends and do it, you know, try to do it every year, and you're sleeping in the van and the whole thing. How long does it take to actually get to Valdez from Sheep Mountain, 200 miles?
It takes, the soloists can do it in around 24 hours.
Do they just ride straight through?
They ride straight through.
Oh my gosh, that sounds really, really exhausting.
And the relay teams take close to 16 to 24 hours also, depending on the rate they want to go in.
Because they are getting some rest, so they can go faster than the solo riders.
They do.
Yeah, what do you usually do?
I do the 100 solo. I haven't done it in a couple of years because now I'm doing the announcing up there and I'm starter up there, and so I just spend the day racing, announcing.
So you don't get to ride at all?
I don't get to ride anymore. I go up there the day before, and I ride to 50.
Uh-huh. So the 100 is not getting all the way to Valdez. Where do you stop with that one?
Glen Allen.
You go out and come back? Or?
Go out and back.
I see. 100 miles of riding your bike pretty fast is exhausting, eh? Is that similar to running a marathon, do you think?
I would think it is real similar on that edge.
Uh-huh.
We have aid stations every 27 miles or 25 miles, and they're handled by our volunteers, our donor groups that we donate money to that handle the aid stations and keep everybody well fueled up for this ride.
Uh-huh. So they are handing out food and Gatorade and that sort of thing.
Gatorade, snacks, bananas,
yeah.
Cookies.
Do most people have a high quality racing bike, or what kind of bikes are people using on this?
They have a full range of bikes, from the elite bikes to snow bikes. We've had fat bikes.
Wow.
Last year we had a fat bike division where a relay team that raced to Valdez. They did the 200, and the first time I've ever seen a snow bike with aero bars on it. Unfortunately, I didn't see it in action, but they'd had a good time.
Huh. That would make it really hard, I would think.
I think so. They had baldy tires on the snow bike, but it's still pretty fat tires.
Huh, interesting. So 650 people is a lot of people to manage. What does it take to put this thing on?
We have a group of about 12 main volunteers that organize everything. Between package pickup and registration and setting up the airstrip and handing out food after the ride at Sheep Mountain Lodge. We have Papa Murphy's Pizza come back. And
what's it? What airstrip?
Sheep Mountain airstrip. I go up the night before and set it up for camping.
Oh, I
see. You can overnight camp there and park there. And then Sheep Mountain Lodge is just a quick walk through the woods to the lodge. And that's
where the
starting
stuff.
Activities are.
I got you. Because there's nowhere near enough hotel rooms up there for 650 people.
No, we pretty much book all the little lodges up there.
Yeah.
They enjoy us being there.
So how many people are working on putting this on?
We have a group of about 15 core people, and then each of them have maybe four or five volunteers under them. And that's about it.
It's a huge production, yeah. What about the safety aspect? Because the highway is still functioning, right? There's still trucks and cars zooming by. How do you keep the cyclists away from the vehicles?
We get a road permit from the state, and they tell us where we need our signage. And we have professional people that stop traffic when for the starts. And the state of Alaska has swept the road, the edges, so most of it is in pretty good shape, and
we're able to stay
on the shoulders for the bulk of the ride.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's really an issue. Our rural highways tend to get deep in gravel and glass and all kinds of junk.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. I wish they'd sweep the shoulders everywhere, huh?
Me too, yeah.
So, and then you get to Valdez, and what happens down there?
Down in Valdez, if you're only doing the 200, you get to enjoy the Chamber of Commerce. Valdez puts on a big fish fry down there with hamburgers and burgers and music, and a good time and music.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, I've not been there to experience that. We have our own Valdez division that organizes that down there, but I hear very good things about it, and people...
Because you're stuck up at Sheep Mountain, yeah.
I'm at the Sheep Mountain finishing line.
So, and then you're waiting for those people who actually ride all the way to Valdez, and then they ride back up Thompson Pass and ride all the way back to Sheep Mountain.
That's the 400s that turn around at Sheep Mountain, or Valdez, and head back up the pass.
And those have got to be some amazing athletes. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing to do.
Yes. And weather can be a major factor in that.
Oh, I'm sure, if it's raining and windy and stuff.
We've experienced all four seasons in a weekend. Even snow in Thompson Pass there.
Wow. Do you ever call it off because the weather's just too bad?
No, but we've had to pull a couple riders because of frostbite and hypothermia.
Oh, my gosh.
We just had to get them warmed up.
That's got to be an unusual problem in a bike race.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Weekend after 4th of July.
Yeah. So you have those aid stations all the way along that long distance for both directions, huh?
Approximately every 25 miles, we have an aid station, a full operational aid station that's got emergency supplies and radio communication. We have a radio setup that goes all the way down to Valdez because cell phones don't always work. And we have Don Lederhaus in charge of that. He sets up repeater stations and sets everybody up so we can all communicate and know what's going on.
Wow, that's amazing. So these people who are doing it both ways, the 400 mile or 400K?
400 mile.
400 mile ride. Do they have any kind of mandatory rest?
they have no mandatory rest, but they have a support vehicle that rides behind them, monitoring them and their health.
I see. So, but by the time they're done with 400 miles, they must have been riding like 2 days straight.
24 hours.
So they can do it all the way down there and all the way back in 24 hours.
Yes.
Amazing. I mean, that's really impressive.
This year's finisher did it in just under 26 hours. He did it this year.
Uh-huh. And who was that?
That was Ben Lefebvre's. Actually, he did it in 29 hours, 49 minutes, and 42 seconds.
I just can't imagine working out that hard for that long. It seems like it would be completely exhausting.
They are. It's amazing to see how a rider comes in after 400 miles. They're almost like the edge of being a zombie, but they did it. And the hot the chocolate milk that we have at the finish line always puts a smile on their face.
Yeah.
Makes them realize it wasn't that bad.
So how many cyclists actually did that this year?
We had a small contingent of two.
Only two people did it,
400 miles time trial solos. Ben Lefebvre's and Kuba Wolves. Kuba did it in 31 hours, 45 minutes, 39 seconds.
So you're out there sort of waiting for these guys, and there's only two competitors.
Right, and that's why we started it in the 400 on Friday, and actually the start time is right at noon on Friday before, so they finish up in the early hours on Saturday morning, Saturday evening.
You know, so you're not hanging around for days, yeah?
Yeah, we've had some finish it late as 10:30, 11 o'clock after the whole day of Fireweed weekend, and it puts a strain on the volunteers that have to stay after watching, waiting. So
yeah,
we moved it back.
So the vast majority then are doing the 200 or the 100?
The 200 is the most popular.
Uh-huh.
And the 150 mile rides are just followed up by a close third.
And it's mostly people are just doing this for fun. I mean, they're not doing it because they're trying to win.
Right, yeah. It's mostly just a nice, pleasant weekend away with family and friends.
Yeah, although that much time on your bike, you'd probably be a little ginger sitting down at work on Monday.
Yeah, Mondays can be tough, but...
All right, well, thanks so much for being here. I've really enjoyed learning more about the Fireweed 400. My guest has been Ralph Camillus, who is a member of the board that puts on this amazing event. What a lot of effort and what a lot of coordination it takes, and carrying it forward into the future. Thanks for being here, Ralph.
Thank you, Charles.
And that's all for today's show. Thanks for being with us on Outdoor Explorer. I want to thank our earlier guests as well. We heard from Will Ross, who's the co-race director of the Frosty Bottom race that is going to be happening shortly here in Anchorage, and also from Katie Merchant, who is the race director of the Iditarod Invitational, which takes place in February, runs all the way up to Nome. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Eric Bork is our producer. Hannah Duro is our assistant producer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.